Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Legacy Finance Committee meeting to order. Welcome back. It's nice to see everybody and nice to hear all the chatting and communication. You forgot to wash your face, sir, Scrubba?
Yeah.
No, you look great, sorry.
That's okay. I started like this and it just kept going.
Well, welcome back, everyone, and it's just really nice to see everyone. We have a few new faces. With on the DFL side, we have Chelsea Ray helping with our DFL research, and a little trivia on her. She's a pretty darn good hockey player. I don't know how many hours a week you spend on the ice, but
it's
pretty impressive.
There's a game today.
It's at Pleasant. And then I've got one from Pleasant to Oxford.
So a goalie coach or a goalie plays out and refs. I don't think I'd want to be a ref of anything personally, but bless you for doing it. And then we have a new page. Welcome aboard. Thank you. Could you just stand and say your name, please?
I'm Maddie Ryan.
Thank you, Maddie. Thank you for being here. So again, welcome back. And before we get going here, we have one other news. We have one of our members has a new baby, our vice chair. And I don't know if you want to introduce the name of our new baby, but congratulations. So I think that's pretty exciting news.
Thank you, Chair. And the baby's name is Simone, and she's 1 month old as of yesterday.
Congratulations.
Lack of sleep.
Oh, who needs sleep? Overrated.
We're still trying to figure out day and night.
Thank so you, pretty Chair. Exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I happened to see a picture and just a beautiful young lady. So that's awesome. So I don't know if anybody's had an opportunity to look at the minutes from our previous meeting going way back to March 29, 23, believe it or not. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Vice Chair, have you had an opportunity to peek at those? And if so, would you be willing to move them for the March 29, 23 meeting?
Yes, I move. Thank you.
Any questions regards to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you, Vice Chair. Those minutes are approved. So so today we're looking into, we're kind of a little bit of an odd place. We're ours, you know, we heard the forecast generally. And what our future might mean for the legislature, and that affects us as well. But ours is cash, so it's a little bit different story. So I've asked our STAR team to kind of go through our funds, because I just think that's really a good for members to kind of know what we're dealing with and the public, so that we kind of know what is ahead of us. And then later on, we're going to hear a proposal from the Lazard Sams, who is kind of. One-third of our funds basically goes to them and, you know, to the group, and then has a proposal that's coming forward. We'll hear more about what they're doing with the funds, and then in this case, the surplus of additional funds that were added to that. So, Mr. Hagemeyer, if you're willing, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, I can give a brief update on the amount of funds available for each of the funds based on appropriations that were made last year and the forecast in November. Three of the funds have biennial funding that was made last year. Outdoor Heritage had annual recommendations, so they have a larger amount available, you'll see, and the recommendations will be in front of you shortly. I should say between the appropriations that were made last year based on the February of 2023 forecast, and a number of changes go into the amount that shows up in the November of 23 forecast, you'd have changes in tax receipts in 23, 24, 25. Also, any funds that rolled forward that from close that canceled on June 30th of last year would roll forward into there, and then any change in investment income. So there's actually like seven or eight pieces that kind of add to the balance going forward. But as you can see, under the Outdoor Heritage Fund, there's $180 million for the biennium, or basically this year, and the recommendations that council has. So in front of you will be that amount. Under the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, there's an additional $11 million based compared to what was appropriated last year. The Clean Water Fund, there's $18 million beyond what was appropriated last year. And then in the Parks and Trails Fund, there's $6.1 million beyond what was appropriated last year. And these all account for a 5% reserve calculation that was put into statute in 2017, maybe 2018. It was at least a half a dozen years ago. The reserve requirement was put in statute so that future forecasts won't put any of these funds negative because they're based solely on sales tax revenues. I can answer any questions on that if you want. If not, right behind there on the following pages, you'll just see kind of a funding history. I didn't plan on going into any depth on this, but you can see since the start of the legacy funds, how much has been the tax receipts each year, the appropriations that were made, and then the total expenditures from those funds. And you'll always see a huge spike in the expenditure number for the current fiscal year, just because any funds that have more than 1 year availability roll into the current year until the end of the current year, then they'd roll into the next year if they had 2, 3, 4, 5 years availability. So they sit in the current fiscal year. So that's why you see a large spike there. That's all I have, Mr. Chair, unless there's any questions for me.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hagemeyer, I have two quick questions. So will the next forecast, will that be, what will that show? And then go ahead with that.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what it'll show, but it will show us the most up-to-date numbers for the the balance that we can use. The end of the month, there's a February forecast that all the appropriations made for this session will be based on the February forecast. I don't know the exact date it's coming out. It's the end of February, beginning of March. So those would be the numbers we'd use. It could vary from these up or down. And then we'd make a new 5% reserve calculation based on that. These dollar amounts are available to appropriate under the 5% reserve based on the forecast, but there is no requirement that you do appropriate any additional dollars for the funds that had appropriations last year.
And before other questions, if there are any, would these numbers reflect any turnbacks or any money coming back to these funds?
Mr. Chair, yes. The turnbacks would be like typically a cancellation would happen at the fiscal close. So June 30th of last year, any appropriations that would have expired there, technically it happens in like August when the reports come back. So any money that would have expired last year that was unexpended would be turned back into the balance already. If there's projects that you happen to know won't be happening, but they still have legal authority on them to spend them, those don't show up yet. But if that occasionally happens where a project isn't gonna go through, maybe for example, in Outdoor Heritage, there's a parcel of land they anticipated buying and it's no longer available or got sold to someone else. So there's money sitting there, it was for that. They have till 27 to spend it, but there's no way they're gonna spend it. So they could amend the language and change how it's for a new purpose, or you could cancel that early in law, but that wouldn't show up in the balance yet. And I wouldn't know what those are. You'd have to know from the recipient.
Any member questions? Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad, so every fund has a positive balance over what we spent last year. So like the 180, that million. So, and if there are projects, what I was trying to figure out is if there's a project in there that got, you know, we're not going to, it got turned back, but they want us to act on it to extend it. Do we have any of those projects that you're aware of?
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, maybe Outdoor Heritage isn't the best example because they have their annual recommendations.
Okay.
So the $180 million is there, but they haven't received a fiscal year 25 appropriation yet. But the other funds had fiscal year 24 and 25 appropriations last year. So the dollar amount shown there in the block, basically the $11 million, $18 million, and $6 million, is additional money beyond what was appropriated last year that is available to be appropriated if you want. As far as extending any appropriations, there's typically some that want them. I don't know. Those groups typically would come to you guys first and let you know that they're interested in having a grant extended or appropriation extended. And then certainly that happens in the various funds.
Mr. Chair, but none of those numbers are shown on here at all.
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, typically you would see those. An example of that would be something that would be expiring June 30th of this year, so fiscal year 24. They have a deadline of June 30th of this year. So it's still available, but they know they're not getting it done in time. They need another field season or something like that. So they want to extend it to June 30th of 25. Occasionally there's issues where something maybe already expired and they try to get it re-extended or something, but those are less normal, I guess. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both. Any other member questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Hagemeyer. And I know you're available for additional questions. And then as the additional forecast comes out in the next few days, we'll adjust accordingly. So we're going to move on to the Outdoor Heritage. Come on up, Mr. Johnson and team. So as all members, I hope you know by the second, by idiom, that the Lessard Sam's portion, the Outdoor Heritage, the 33% that goes there is an annual appropriation, where the other is biennial. And so they've had an opportunity to meet and to come up with proposals. It's quite a large number, as you can see, 180 million. I think originally, I think it was it 30 some million less? And I think they had an opportunity to meet to have additional proposals. And so today with us, we have Mr. Johnson. I know you're always available for questions and whatnot. I asked my staff to bring down your folder. When Representative Green used to be on the committee, he always wanted to look at the folder. So if anybody wants to look at the binder and study it, we have, I don't know where it is. It's somewhere in here. So there it is. It's if you want a little bit of light reading during the afternoon session, maybe you're a fast reader. But there's quite a few proposals. So we invited Mr. Johnson. He's going to come back when the actual bill comes forward. I think I have the bill here for signing if you're interested. But right now we kind of want him to go through some of what's in the bill and the proposals that are in there and some of the – and maybe tell some of the stories that that are going on in this space. So I thought it would be good to – hit the ground running right away in the session. And Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. And I know you're available. I don't know where you are now. You were literally around the corner in the basement there, but where's your office now? You might want to tell us and how for members or to be able to reach you during your presentation. Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Lead Backer, and members. Nice to see you all again, Mr. Chair. We are now located in Centennial on first floor. Opposite end as the legislative, as the OLA. So you could find us quite easily, although you might have to still go. No, I think your cards will work on the door that'll let you in. So otherwise, the security will let you in if you want. The Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Johnson. For the record, I'm the executive director of the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. Today with me, we have my assistant director, Joe Pavelko. Also, we have David Stein, who's a coordinator for CPL, and Tim Terrell is here. He's the executive director of the the Mississippi Headwaters Board, and David Ruff is a conservation program manager with the Conservation Fund. These gentlemen will each be having a portion of today's presentation so we can give you a good overview of outdoor heritage funds and how they hit the ground and how they affect, how they benefit the game and fish habitat in Minnesota as well as Minnesota citizens. I'm going to be brief so that our star-studded lineup can take over. But I'll start by calling your attention to two handouts in your packet. The first is this handout that has the photos and bios of the council members for the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. Unfortunately, you don't get a chance to meet all of them, and you still don't, but at least you get a chance to see who they are and find out a little about them. As a recap, the council is made up of 12 members. Four are legislators, two from each of the two bodies. And there are eight citizens, and the citizen members are appointed four by the governor, two by the House, and two by the Senate. The citizen members have terms of 4 years, and the legislators, of course, serve at the pleasure of their respective body. In your packet, there's also a second handout, which is this one. It's the call for funding requests. This happens to be the one that was released last spring, in April. And each year, the call for funding request goes out April 1. It's closed about 60 days later, the end of May, and it's a pretty straightforward process. The what happens is then the council in the end of June gets a packet like that, this binder up here, 4-inch thick binder, of all of the different proposals that come in and all of the detail with each of the proposals, what they plan on doing, how they plan on doing it, how it affects our natural resources, how it affects endangered species, what the budget is, how the budget breaks down, all kinds of things. The and so the council members get that, and they pretty much have the first couple weeks of July, or at least, to take a look at those proposals in depth, each one of them, and they do. They go through, walk through them each, and they score them based on a set list of 12 criteria that is on page 5 within this call for funding requests. The I say that they score them, and that's to kind of give everybody a real feel for what each of the proposals are, how they stack up not only to the criteria, but also to statutory and constitutional requirements that are of the funds. The council then gets together and goes through these scorings of all of the members, each member's individual scorings as well as the cumulative of the group, so they can get an idea of listening to each other talk about what did you think, why did you think that, and then they get a chance to also converse about what are, you know, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. It's a chance for them to really dig into the proposals. And then the next step they do is in August, end of August or the beginning of September, council has 2 to 3 days of hearings where each of the proposers gets to come in and talk about why they think their program is the best. Why should they be funded? So it's their sales pitch, so to speak. It gives the council a really different view of each of the proposals, because when you hear it in person, it's definitely different than reading it on paper. Sometimes it is to the benefit of the proposer, other times it's to their detriment, where the council may say, this isn't really what it sounds like on paper. But it's kind of that vetting process that is a wonderful mix of a whole bunch of things that add toward the recommendations that the council ends up with. After that meeting in August, after those hearings, then the council members get a chance, I don't want to miss, the last day especially, of the hearings, the council takes time at the end of the day to really discuss what they've heard. Is there something that's alarming to them? Is there something that they felt was really missed? What are their impressions going forward? And then from there, then the council members get a chance over the next couple weeks to put down what they think should be the funding recommendations for each of these proposals, or not funding for each of these proposals. So it's an elimination process based on the vetting that each member has done and that the council has done as a whole. Then in September, the council gets together at beginning of October. They review these together, these fiscal scorings, we'll call them, and get a chance to really decide what makes sense and where is their consensus. Because in that group of 53 presentations that we had this last fall, there were two, I think, that were not funded in the requests, by in the recommendations by the council. And there were several of them that only had 6 or 7 of the 12 members recommending funding. So all of that is, and the two that weren't funded were below that half mark, below that six number. So it's a big process. It works together quite well, I think, and over the years has proven to be pretty accurate. Now, it doesn't mean that there isn't legislative or partisan, you know, opinions that will happen when it comes to the legislature with the recommendations. And I'm sure there's got to be some nuance of partisanship within the council itself, because we are all individuals, although not me and Joe, we're nonpartisan, yeah. So you remember. But at any rate, it all comes together for the recommendations that you'll be seeing in the bill this year. I'm going to turn it over now to Mr. Pavelko, and I'll remove from the seat so our next person can come up that's behind him. But Joe can give you a view of kind of how those recommendations from the council shook out this year, and he'll be followed by CPL, then Mississippi Headwaters, and then Southeast Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Good morning. I always call you Joe, so sorry. Mr. Pavelko, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to walk through this handout right here. I'm going to go pretty quickly. It's going to be a high-level overview of the recommendations from the council this year, and then later on through this process, if you want, we can get more specific with the actual bill itself. This year, the council recommended 50 programs to get funding for a total of $180,711,000. That totals about 62,000 acres that's going to be restored, enhanced, or protected. And interesting this year is it's about 77.3 miles of shoreline will be restored, enhanced, or protected. And just to compare that to last year's number was 40.7 miles. So it's almost double, and you'll see how that translates in the numbers in the next page. There's about $34 million of other funds that will be leveraged with this money. 38 different organizations are going to receive money, one federal agency, two state agencies, 15 local units of government. That's more than normal. There's a lot of interest in the local governments, watershed districts, soil and watersheds, those types, and then 20 non-government organizations. The money constitutes 75% is previously funded programs, so you'll see like phase one, two, all the way up to even 16. So 75% of that money is going to phase programs. If you look on the next page, you'll see how everything breaks down by acres and by funds. I'll call your attention to the left side, output by acres. You'll see compared to other years that there's a more even distribution of acres, and that's for two reasons. We have what's called a Minnesota roving cruise, and that is money that goes to DNR for staff to do on the ground conservation work. That's like burning, wetland restoration enhancement, but truly on the ground type stuff. And their numbers are really high when they get funds, but they're on a 2-year cycle. And so this year they didn't come in for money. So that's why the acres are a little bit lower. And then the other reason is that a lot of the extra or new projects, are related to water, especially like streams and rivers. And because of that, the cost per acre is really high because you're dealing with heavy equipment and just the permitting process and that whole thing. So it's just the cost per acre are really high. So that's why our total acre output is a little bit less than what it normally would be if we had a focus on other areas besides water, and then also because of the Minnesota roving cruise. If you look on the right side, you'll see how everything lays out with funds by activity. As usual, the cost to restore land is more than enhancing land. So if you look on the very bottom graph there, it kind of shows the total cost for wetlands for restore activities, enhance, and just, you know, quick rundown, it's approximately $3,000 an acre to restore versus approximately $1,000 an acre to enhance. And then if you look on the habitat side in that same graph, the total there is $13,828,000, and that equals about $69,000 an acre. And when we are reporting, we're reporting acres but also feet. And so when you're working on a stream, that's why the costs are so high, because, you know, we're working in a stream bed and you need the permits and the heavy equipment, or, you know, bulldozers and all that kind of stuff, and that's why it's so expensive. And that's just a very quick overview of the bill. If you look on the front side, there's a neat picture that I thought we should include. On the bottom left there, it says forest enhancement, and then you'll see in the very middle of the picture, there's a little sign there, and that's an OHF sign, and it's got the partners of all the organizations that were part of this project. And then all those little tracks in there, they look like footprints. Those are actual moose tracks. So this was a project that was done in northeast Minnesota, and it was for the benefit of moose. And as you can see, if you build it, they will come. And also, interesting enough, moose also know how to read. So they saw the sign and thought, hey, let's go in there and have a snack. So, you know, the next three presenters are all builders of the habitat, and I'm hoping that, you know, in the backs of their minds, that maybe Kevin Costner's, you know, saying, if you build it, they will come. And hopefully it's the Kevin Costner from Field of Dreams and not the Kevin Costner from Yellowstone. So, the next three presenters will be the builders, and they're the ones that actually do the on-the-ground work. So with that, I'll turn it over to David.
Mr. Provucco, before we move on, Chair Lee has a question.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just curious, what is the federal agency that's recommended for funding, and how much money are they bringing in to their project?
Mr. Provucco.
Mr. Chair and members, maybe I misspoke. They're a partner. It's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're a partner with a lot of the projects, especially with wetland projects and prairie projects. And they bring millions of dollars into it. I don't know the exact number that the Fish and Wildlife is bringing to the table, but I can get that exact number to you, but it's in the millions.
Chair Lee.
All right. Thank you, Chair. So just last follow-up, can you send us a link of where we can find information for all these projects that are recommended, please? Thank you.
Mr. Provucco.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, will do.
One thing, it'd be nice to, there's some overlap. I'm glad Chair Lee asked some questions, because I'm lucky enough to serve on his committee too, and I still continue to find it a little confusing of what's funded through Lessard SAMS and clean water funds and versus through traditional bonding sources. So if you can kind of explain some of the keep trying to explain some of the overlaps, and because, you know, we push for a large number there, but then I saw that there's RIM on one of the project is a RIM project, and then, you know, anyways, I please be aware of that, and we'll have more questions there.
Mr. Chair, we can, when we actually go through the bill, we can talk about those specific breakouts too.
Perfect. Welcome. I'm excited to hear this presentation. So a few years ago, we added the grant program on Lessard SAMS. I don't know if Representative Heitzman was on at the time of that. I think I was when it first started, and it's actually, and then it's gotten even better. Mm-hmm. And I think we've, and you're part of the reason. So we're excited to see what you're doing, the funds. Those funds have grown in the last few years, and it's very, very popular. I think it's, again, going back to Chair Lee's committee, I mean, the requests are greater than the you know, that you face every day, that are greater here than the money. Well, that's true with all of Lessard's funds. But go ahead, sir. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Stein. I am the coordinator of the CPL program over at the Minnesota DNR. I have a presentation pulled up, and it's also located in your files for today. But I will get started and be brief. So this is just going to serve as a general overview of the CPL program, as well as some of our main accomplishments for the last year, for last year's appropriations, as well as overall throughout the program's life. So just as a general overview of the CPL program, it was created during the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Constitutional Amendment. That legislation required a Conservation Partners Program, which is the CPL program right now, to encourage local conservation efforts. Specifically, it was to provide matching funds or matching grants for the restoration, protection, and enhancement of wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. And all of our funding, just like Lessard SAMS, comes from the sales tax. So within the CPL program, we have two main designations of our grants. So we have larger grants. These are split between metro projects, traditional or statewide projects, as well as new applicant projects, which was added last year during last year's appropriations. These are larger grants between $5,000 and $500,000. We have up to two grant cycles. This last year, we only had one due to the popularity of the program. We are out of funds, so we only had one grant cycle. We allow private land under these larger grants as long as they're under a permanent conservation easement. Acquisitions are also allowed for these grants due to the larger grant amount that's awarded. And these are open-ended habitat projects. So there are a mix and match of different habitats and different projects that are being done on the ground. Our smaller grants are known as expedited conservation projects, or ECP. These are smaller again. They're between $5,000 and $50,000. We have up to five grant cycles annually, so they're on mostly a rolling basis. We only do these grants on public land, so land owned by a unit of government or a school. No acquisitions are allowed, just based on the low amount of money that we award here. And it's limited to a list of specific activities that we list on our website. It just helps the grant become more expedited. We can take a look at the methods for each project that's going on the ground and quickly approve or tell them to go back to the drawing board for that. So just a little bit more about our traditional and metro cycles. So traditional is statewide projects. They can occur all across the state. Metro projects can only occur in the 7-county metro area. These are Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington counties, as well as the larger cities of St. Cloud and Duluth and Rochester. Those cities are above 50,000 people in population. These projects, again, range from $5,000 to $500,000, and they cannot exceed $1 million total, including both our funding from CPL as well as their match. New for this year, another large grant round was added based on the legislative requirements of last year. This is the new applicant round. Again, the rules for this one are pretty much the same as traditional and metro projects. The only difference is they can take place throughout the entire state, and the applicants can only be new applicants to the CPL program. They cannot have received funding from us or LSOHC previously. The grant requests for this one, again, are $5,000 to $500,000. The total project with match cannot exceed $1 million, and they are open to restoration, enhancement, and acquisition projects. And finally, our expedited projects, a little more detail about that. These are restoration and enhancement projects only. They range from $5,000 to $50,000. This is a very quick evaluation and award period, so we only take about 2 months to award these out to our recipients. And only certain projects are covered, so we can limit the amount of projects that come in, and we can keep awarding them on a very quick notice. For our match requirements, again, just an overview of what match is. They are cash, goods, and services provided by the grantee to the project, so they have some buy-in to the project, so everyone's contributing to the overall success of our projects. We require 10% of the grant award to be included by our grantees. Cash match can be payments towards habitat work. They can be payments by the grantee to contractors. They can be payments to vendors for native seed or equipment rental. An in-kind match can include volunteers, equipment use and rental, and then value assigned to goods. Primarily, that's usually seed mixes provided by some of the partners that they harvest by hand. Eligibility requirements for CPL. Only nonprofit organizations and government agencies may apply for the CPL program. Projects need to be on permanently protected land, so that's either public land or private land covered by a permanent conservation easement. Individuals are not eligible, but they are encouraged to partner with some of these larger government and nonprofit organizations. We've seen a lot of individuals take it on themselves to reach out to either their lakes associations or their SWCDs or their local government to get projects put together in partnership between both those individuals and the government or nonprofit who will apply on their behalf. Just general timelines with CPL. The online application system opens every year on August 1st. The traditional metro and new applicant, or the larger grants, are announced who got funded in early January. Contracts are set up in December and Contracts are set up in December and January for the project to get started. Our expedited conservation projects are open continuously. Funds are awarded about every other month, and we have up to 5 rounds every year. And awards are announced 4 weeks after each project round closes, just to keep it on a consistent schedule. And each project has up to 3 years to complete. Again, going off of timelines, our traditional metro and new applicant grants, we have a 6-month process on how these are scored and evaluated. They start each with a technical review committee based on habitat type. So we have one review committee on prairies, one review committee on forests, and one review committee on fish, game, wildlife, and wetlands. It then moves on to the DNR division directors of Fish and Wildlife, Ecological and Water Resources, and Forestry. They will review what our technical review committee suggested, add their own input, whether a project is fundable or not, and then pass it along to the DNR commissioners who make the final decisions on who gets funded and who does not get funded. Again, that's a 6-month process. Our expedited conservation projects, they only go up to our DNR habitat team. We have specialists for prairies, forests, streams, wetlands, and other habitats for fish, game, and wildlife. After they get approval from that habitat team, they move over to the Fish and Wildlife Division Director's office, so both the Division Director and Deputy Director review them and either give their funding approval or their lack of approval. And again, that's about a two-month process. Evaluation criteria is the same across all of our grants that we give out. They are judged under six different evaluation criteria. Overall project value, what the habitat quality and quantity will be. Applicant performance, if there's local support for each of these projects, if collaboration is present, and for non-new applicants, if previous grantee performance has been acceptable in the CPL program. Project benefits, if there are habitat benefits, and what habitat benefits are present, again, quantity and quality. Public benefits, if there's public access, if people have access to hunting, fishing, hiking, and other recreation opportunities on the landscape, that's brought into the evaluation criteria. Financial assessment, if they're cost effective, why are they cost effective? If they're not cost effective, why are they not cost effective? And if the budget is detailed and showing where all of our grant funds are going to be going in high amounts of detail. And then urgency. This is usually associated with acquisitions. If there is a risk that these parcels are going to be sold off, we want to make sure that they have a high amount of urgency. Or if there is a fish passage culvert that's currently crumbling and there's other engineering problems, we want to make sure that those are on the ground. So our results of this year, our successes so far, our new applicant round, which was our newest grant round that we started this year, legislatively, it was required to have $3 million available. We had a total of 12 applicants for that round with $3.1 million in requests. All of our grant requests or all of our grant funds for this round were used, and we have eight grantees funded that are new to the program. For our metro round, we had $2.5 million available. Again, that is legislatively required. We had, again, 12 applicants with $4.1 million in requests for our metro applicants. We had to tighten the budget a little bit for there, and we were only able to award eight grantees their funds. But again, all of those funds have been used up this year. Our statewide round, again, was listed at $2.5 million available. We had 10 applicants with around $3.4 million in requests, and eight grantees were funded due to the limitations of the $2.5 million. And finally, our expedited conservation projects, or ECP, we had $1 million available. We had 33 applicants. Three of them were new. They didn't go through the new applicant round. Instead, they went through the ECP round. We had $1.3 million in requests after three rounds this year, and a total of 24 grantees were funded. Those funds are also all used up this year. So looking ahead at fiscal year 25, because we had such high demand this year, we are boosting our request from the Lazard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. We are requesting $15 million in allocation from LSOHC, and we're going to be partnering that with more outreach directly to new and underserved applicants for CPL. With this, our new breakdown this year, we're just based on what we've seen last year from our requests. We're requesting $4.4 million for traditional or statewide applicants, $4 million for new applicants, $4 million for metro applicants, $2 million for ECP or expedited conservation projects, and then $600,000 for administrative costs. And we're going to be adding on to our staffing capacity to assist with that outreach and recruitment for the CPL program. And my goal for this year is to have at least 90 applications in our system and hopefully 90 grants being funded. And then just a general overview of the CPL program. On the left, you can see a map of where all of our projects are located statewide. We have some areas that we are looking to expand into this year, and that's where we're getting our increased staffing capacity and hopefully adding more to that outreach effort. But between 2010 and 2024, we've funded over 1,000 projects through the CPL program. We just reached our 1,000th project this year, so with your continued support, we've been able to do these 1,000 projects on the ground. Over 260 organizations, unique organizations, have partnered with us to get these projects funded on the ground. And probably the most shocking and most out there number, we've had over 585,000 acres of habitat be restored, enhanced, or protected through the CPL program. And with that, that is the CPL program, just a general overview and some of our successes this past year. If you need to reach out to me, that's my number and my email address, and I'll take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Stein, and thank you for the overview, and thank you for taking, you know, the new applicant effort serious. That was a house position that we added, and it really hit the ground running, and thank you for your work on this. And so we have a couple of member questions. Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the presentation. I really appreciate that. I've served on this commission, if I remember correctly. What is it specifically, Mr. Chair? Do you recall the – forget it.
I'm sorry, Representative Heitzman. I was looking who was next to ask
That's
questions.
That's okay. I'll get
Go
to
ahead,
the
ask
question.
It again if you want.
No, it's slide 8.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could remind me, why is it that projects can only be done on permanently protected land? I'm sure there's a good reason, but I can imagine, like probably a lot of other folks, that there's opportunities on land that may be transitional. There may be, I mean, forests change, and there may be all sorts of easements and other opportunities. And there's probably a good reason, but I can't remember what it was.
Yes. Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heitzman, I believe the reason is that if we want to put money towards these habitat projects, we want to have that additional security that they will remain in place. Just so these, if we say do a prairie in that area, if it's permanently protected, we have the sort of security that it's not going to be removed, and same with a forest or a wetland. So having those permanent protections in place gives both our reviewers and our program a little bit more security, knowing that our funding is being put down permanently on the landscape.
Representative Heitzman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm trying to recall, like I just said, exactly what the objection was to trying to take advantage of what is, I think, a growing number of easements. I'm not sure that we're going to make a bunch of recommendations today, but I do think there's probably an opportunity there. I'm not sure if there's probably there maybe is another program that catches those. But if not, I hope the Lessard Sams is looking at that. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Finke. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Chair Lilly. Chair and Vice Chair, I apologize for my tardiness today. So,
okay.
You know, first day. So I was just looking at the numbers, and I noticed that in the 2023 grant request, the need seemed greater in the metro than the statewide, and then in the 2024 request, the statewide goes up 400,000 and the metro stays. I'm just curious what the logic is of that change.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Finke, statewide projects can be funded in the metro area. The metro is specifically set aside for their own distinct rounds, but they're not limited to those funds. So we can have people within the metro apply for state round if they see fit. The reason for the switch is mostly historic. This past round, we've had more funding in the metro area, but historically, we've had more funding in the statewide rounds. So we're just going off of our history before this year and allocating resources as we saw fit.
Representative Finke.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. So I want to focus in a little bit on the match requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think it's pretty understandable what is a cash match. How do you go about valuing volunteer hours, equipment use, and is there a consistent policy that lays out how those are valued?
Mr. Stein.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, those are for volunteer and equipment usage. That's based on the federal volunteer and mileage rates. For equipment usage, we usually will have our grantees research into how expensive reserving a vehicle or reserving equipment will be in their local area where they can reserve this equipment, and we use that as a basis of getting our match values.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Last follow-up then, just more of the 1,000 projects that you have funded through the CPL,
mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how many have used other non-state sources as a match, for example, capital investment as a match for this program or not. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do not allow state match for our program. All match has to come either locally, federally, or through donations from, if it's a nonprofit, they have to have donations from their members who buy in. So we do not allow state match to be used in the CPL program.
Thank you.
Representative Shaw?
Yes. Can I request for a report on the slide number 12, the CPL 2024 results? Mm-hmm. I guess there were 19 programs that were not funded, and then there were 77 that were funded. Mm-hmm. Just like to get more information on what kind of projects these are.
Mr. Stein.
Yes, Chair Lilly and Representative, the projects that were not funded for a variety of reasons. Several of them actually dropped out. They had found either funding for their project through different sources, or they had decided that they did not have time to do some of these projects. Other projects were not funded for a variety of reasons, but I can get you that report. When we move forward. Just something to follow up with that. If a project is not funded, we will always send out a follow-up email on how to improve an application. We see these projects as temporarily not funded, not dead in the water. So we will send out an email explaining what to fix on an application. These are what our feedback was from our reviewers. And moving forward, this is how you can change your application to be funded.
Representative Cha.
I appreciate that. I just want to see an overview. Yep. Instead of just numbers, I want to see what type of projects these are.
Yep.
Thank you.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stein, Chair Lee, in my other life, I was a trail administrator for the DNR for the snowmobile trail, and our volunteer time was valued at a dollar amount, and like a chainsaw was worth something, a pickup truck and so on. And it really was a way to keep track of those matching dollars, you know. So and I'm sure you, if it's the DNR, you still use very similar mm-hmm. things for that. But the question that I have is, of the 585,000 acres, mm-hmm. How many of those acres are enhanced or used for hunting?
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is a good question. We have on our application system whether or not these areas are open to hunting. That's something that I'm going to have to dive through the data and get back to you on.
Okay, because I know Representative, I won't speak for her, but Representative Her and I are hunters. And, you know, the more land that becomes available, you know, it's like, it helps, and I'm a public lands hunter, mm-hmm. so and I'm proud of it. When I go to other states, Minnesota rocks. Mm-hmm. I mean, comparatively, we're light years ahead of others, so I thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, and I will look forward to an answer.
Yep. Point.
Thanks good. Again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scraba. Just been lucky enough to serve on the Lessard Sams, and I think the focus on the money is a little less. It's more habitat, smaller projects but there's plenty of money in giving you sporting opportunities with the other investments of the rest of the funds. Chair Vang?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get a better idea of the type of applicants that apply for the CPL grants versus the Lessard Sams. Is there like a general difference, or are they generally the same type of applicants applying for both sources?
Mr. Stein.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, there is some overlap. However, during our application systems or our application opening, we get a lot of cities and we get a lot of smaller sportsmen's organizations. We have local chapters that generally apply to our programs. And we have a lot of smaller units of government and school districts that apply to our programs as well. So while there is overlap, there is enough of a distinction between the two programs to show that we have a unique clientele versus the overall Lizard Sams.
Thank you. Vice Chair Hussein.
Thank you for your time, and thank you for your presentations. Mm-hmm. The only question that I have is the grant for those seven counties. Mm-hmm. Could they apply multiple grants or just one-time funding?
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair and Representative, they can apply for all of the grants. The metro counties, they have their own funding that can only be used there, but they can also apply to statewide and expedited grants as well. So it's more of a limitation on the funds rather than a limitation on the applicants that can use them.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Are we able to get us any report?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hussein. Appreciate all the questions. We went a little longer, but I'm really excited about this program, and you really seem to be doing a great job, so thank you for that. And I know we're going a little long, but could you just tell us, like, quickly some little neat projects, you know, in each fund maybe that really stuck out? And
yeah. So a good thing that's going on with our program is that we are required to do monitoring on the ground of these larger projects. And I've actually included a couple of those projects that really stood out to me in my PowerPoint. If I can get it open again, just give me one sec. But some of the really cool ones that I've saw these last couple of years, there was one that was up against Frontenac State Park. It directly overlooked Rattlesnake Bluff. It was done by the Minnesota Land Trust. It was a more or less a time capsule to go back to the 1800s on what the land used to be. You can see the bluff with its forests overlooking this vast, I think, 100-plus acre prairie just completely in bloom. And it not only added to the aesthetics of the area and the history of the area, but it also added to the public access to our state park system. So it had Minnesota Land Trust bumped up right against our state park. Another really good one was done by the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. They had decided to start doing a forest diversity project in areas that were overrun with, or really overrepresented with black ash, just in terms of getting it ready for emerald ash borer to inevitably come in. So now there are very diverse stands of cypress and oak and intermixed with that already existing black ash in that area. So we now have much more resilient forests when emerald ash borer does inevitably move on to that area of the state. Additionally, we've had several projects in the metro start using goats as a control method, and it's a very easy way to get involved with the public. The public loves seeing goats within a small area, kind of cooped together, removing this buckthorn, actually seeing it on the ground rather than just your regular hand crews doing some of these projects. It's just a little bit more of a unique interaction between the public and the work that's being done on the ground. But I can keep gushing about all these projects moving forward, but we usually do visits on upwards of 30 to 60 projects a year, and all of them have been fantastic, and we get a lot of documentation, and we work directly on the ground with a lot of our grantees and get to know the projects on a more one-on-one basis. So there's a lot that I can keep going on, but I'll keep the time a little shorter.
Thank you,
Mr. Stein.
Again. And I'm certain you're available for questions.
Yep, exactly.
Thank you. So we're going to switch gears here a little bit, and director from the Mississippi Headwaters, Mr. Terrell, please introduce yourself and go ahead.
My name is Tim Terrell, and I'm the executive director of the Mississippi Headwaters Board.
It's like you're buying some shoes or something.
I'm not quite sure how to pull things up here.
I mean, for you, Mr. Chair, your Valentine's
Day. Where's my presentation?
Is there someone who's done that?
You can bring that up.
No. Or does she know already?
Otherwise, I brought it on.
Oh,
perfect.
We have a floor session at around, is it noon today?
It is. Yeah.
So I just want to try to be able to be out of here maybe about a quarter or two or so, just come maybe a few seconds afterwards. Give people an opportunity. We have a little bit of interesting way to get over there nowadays.
Yeah, I get that off. No more tunnel.
There we go. As I said before, my name is Tim Terrell. I'm the executive director of the Mississippi Headwaters Board. Just kind of want to point out to you a few things. This is a little misnomer here on the, it's not the MHB watershed spotlight. It's actually the Mississippi Headwaters Habitat Corridor Program. So that's a little misnomer there, which is partners of the Mississippi Headwaters Board, the Trust for Public Land, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources, with support from the DNR and the Nature Conservancy. So we just kind of wanted to go over here. This is a very high level approach. I want to emphasize here is we want to target, we do target for building habitat complexes. That is our main purpose. Our ranking sheets are all towards that when we get a parcel. But I just kind of want to show you an example of collaboration at the project level and multiple benefits. And one of those multiple benefits is water quality. And I think the Board of Water and Soil Resources created this slide so we can look at things through a habitat lens, but also through a water quality. So here is a watershed on the Mississippi River. The existing public lands were 37%, so that's what we started with. As we started, we in 2017, there was an acquisition, and it bumped the percent of public land up to 46%. Then we got an easement there as well. So we're starting to fill up that watershed with public land. And then lastly, we threw in what's SFIA, which is another funded program. So you see we went from 37% to 66% protection in a very short amount of time. And then we got another acquisition as well through the Trust for Public Land, and that bumped it up to 71%. And so when we're looking at that, we're looking at it from a numerical data standpoint from water quality. But as I said, we target for habitat, and of course the Mississippi River is the national flyway for birds, but reptiles, terrestrial animals, deer, grouse, all those other animals use it as a highway for travel and a place to breed and use their lung at, raise their young at different life stages and different styles. So this is just a very small segment of what we do. And you can see that we got some protection on both sides of the river to help create a complex. So when we go out there and we're looking at programs, we talk to the landowner. The landowners make the choice. This isn't a regulatory program. They make the choice what they want to do. The MHHCP program with our funding from Lesage SAMS obviously works on the right side here, which is more of a long-term, higher cost, but long-term and permanent. Whereas if you get on the other side of it, it's more planning. So when we talk to the landowner, if they're not interested in any of these land protection, permanent land protection programs, they might just be interested in a conservation plan. And there's funding for that through other programs as well. So it's we're letting the landowner have options. So so basically this watershed was at 20 to 40% protected when we first got there. Now it's in the light green area at 60, I think it was 71%. So that's looking at it from a water quality perspective. Once again, we're targeting for habitat. So final points here is we're creating habitat and water quality complexes at the project and the watershed level, because we're able to do it not just show here's a parcel and here's what was done, but we can show it at a watershed level as well. We have a diverse technical committee that reviews these parcels. A little bit of alphabet soup here, but Mississippi Headwaters Board, Trust for Public Land, Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, the Nature Conservancy, the DNR, the Pheasants Forever, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and some of the counties involved as well. So we protect the, and you know, just a little stat here, we protect the drinking water of the Twin Cities. I got this stat off the Minneapolis water. The Minneapolis draws 21 billion gallons from the Mississippi River every year. That's just Minneapolis. That's not including St. Cloud and some of those. But so we're, you know, why are we here? You guys are dealing with funding. We're just trying to make a connection here. So I got this stat off the internet, so it must be true. But it says that I don't know what a million dollars is, but if I convert it to seconds, I know what a second is. So $1 million is 1 million seconds is equal to 12 days. So that's what a million. Well, what's a billion? A billion seconds is 31.7 years, not days, years. So that kind of shows you a perspective on things. And then a trillion. Well, I mean, we're back in dinosaur era back then, but I think, but, you know, it just kind of gives us a perspective. So another way of looking at this, we know it's cheaper to create habitat and also get water quality at the source rather than to treat it once it gets there and if it's polluted. So it's just kind of, we're doing a double service with multiple benefits. We're creating large habitat complexes, but we're also helping the state in some drinking water and other issues as well. And, you know, another way to put this is if you give us 12 days, we'll give you 31 years. So that's my presentation. Do you have any questions?
Thank you for your presentation. Just really, you know, shows how we're all tied into the water and so important for the, you know, our major, you know, Hennepin County, Minneapolis area and the suburbs and St. Cloud, like you're saying, just protecting those waters. So it's a great side benefit. Representative Chaw.
Yes, often on the internet, we hear that the Mississippi water is drying up and stuff like that. Can you give us some insight on the health of the Mississippi River in terms of in the state of Minnesota?
You know, I can only give you what I've observed last year in 2023. It almost seemed in the spring we were dealing with flooding up where we were at. And then in the summer, August, we couldn't buy enough water as much as there was a very low. So we went from very much extremes, from a lot of water in the spring to very little. And, you know, there were places where I took my kayak on the Mississippi and we bottomed out because it was that. That's a little unheard of. I know that's a bigger issue with barge traffic more south. That really didn't affect us, but it is an issue that, you know, we look at in reading past back in the 1990s. There was a concern from the legislature about water quantity. But, you know, what does this year bring? I mean, we'll see what nature gives us. We have a mild winter. What will that mean? Will we have a heavy spring rain? I really can't comment with numbers, but, you know, the Mississippi, pretty big watershed, and so it reads a lot of water through the groundwater and through rain.
Representative.
How important is the winter weather contribution to the watershed in terms of, you know, snowfall?
You know, it's huge. It's it makes an impact as far as when you get the melt. It will immediately, when it melts, rush into the Mississippi because the ground is still frozen. So it will contribute into the spring. Plus, really, it's in the spring, it's about the spring rains and how much you get there. But, you know, it does take time, as we all learned from seventh grade science. It rains, and then it takes time for the water to get purified running through the soil. But eventually that water, over time, makes it to the Mississippi River. So it's a slow process, but it sustains it throughout the summer as well.
Representative Chaw.
Thank you for your remarks. No further questions.
Thank you. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The number you gave, the billions of gallons for the year, I just did the quick math, and it's 57,534,246 gallons per day.
Wow.
So that's a lot of water, you know. And sitting on the Water Commission, some of the issues that are coming up to the metro area, Representative Fisher had brought up about how there's not enough water for growth in some of the areas. It's an impediment, you know, like they can't get any more groundwater. They can't get water. I don't know. Again, my solution to that problem is in greater Minnesota, we have a lot of water. We have a lot of land. We have a lot of good people that want to help bring in new people to work and move some of these jobs from the metro to us. So just a comment to that. We could use that for that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no more other, no more questions. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I know you'll be available for questions. And if you. So welcome, Mr. Ruff, and please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Pull up my slides here and hopefully we figured out the system to make it go smoothly.
So as he's getting ready, I just want to mention on the back of this very first presentation, we just kind of picked out a few of lines. So, I mean, we could go through every one of these lines with presentations similar to what you're seeing today. So go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly right. I'm thrilled to be here just to kind of show a little bit, one example of the whole slate of projects in front of you. My name is David Ruff. I'm a conservation program manager with the Nature Conservancy. I think Mark slipped and might have said I was with the Conservation Fund, which is an easy mistake to make with a whole bunch of organizations with conservation in their name. But so I work for the Nature Conservancy. I work primarily in Southeast Minnesota, and I have the pleasure of working with our partners on this program, the Trust for Public Land and the Minnesota Land Trust, for our Southeast Minnesota Protection and Restoration Program, which is focused on restoring, enhancing, and protecting habitat in Southeast Minnesota. And for those of you who don't get down to that corner of the state as often, I thought I'd just start with a little bit of a background slide here. And this really captures the essence of the driftless area down there in Southeast Minnesota, these deep cold water stream valleys flanked by steep bluffs that are covered with this diverse mix of prairie, oak savanna, hardwood forests. It's an incredibly biologically diverse part of the state. It's actually the biodiversity hotspot of Minnesota. We have more species of greatest conservation need than anywhere else. And 51% of the plant species that can be found in Minnesota can be found in Southeast Minnesota. So in my opinion, I think it's a really important place to work on conservation. It's also some TNC-led science has really identified it as a place where we expect conservation investments to be really resilient to climate change. There's an inherent resilience in this kind of a varied landscape that we can enhance with our conservation outcomes and give us the best shot and our biodiversity the best shot at adapting to climate change. It's also important to work there because it's got some real threats. So this is a landscape that, like a lot of southern and western Minnesota, is really used to fire, and the loss of disturbance from the past 100 years has left a lot of habitat that's really missing that active management and that active disturbance to keep it healthy. And the challenge in implementing that active management is further compounded by the fact that there's very little public land in Southeast Minnesota. So over 95% of the landscape is in private ownership. And the lesson I take from that is kind of threefold. You know, one, we need to be sure that we're being as effective as possible with the active management that we're able to put on the lands. Two, we need to be increasing the amount of public land on the landscape and growing those really core complexes of protected public conservation land. And then three, we also need to be working with private landowners the way the Minnesota Land Trust does through our program to protect their habitat and conservation ownership, and also work with them on restoration actions that they're interested in. And this is what we've been doing as a partnership with the kind of the benefit of council support for, as the phase 12 in our grant title this year says, you know, over a decade. And one point I'd really like to make is the way that continued and sustained investment adds up over time. And I appreciated Tim's presentation as well, because he had a time lapse in there, and it really shows how with continued work over time, you can build up to actually impacting things at a landscape scale. And so this overview map shows, you know, that in the kind of purple color where we've done restoration enhancement work in partnership with DNR partners and DNR staff. The orange areas are new public lands acquired by the Nature Conservancy and the Trust for Public Land, and the blue areas are Minnesota Land Trust easements. And you can see how this is really adding up. We're connecting corridors. Really targeted around, this is the State Wildlife Action Network in green down here. This all didn't happen in one, certainly not in one year, and not in one appropriation. and an example, kind of zooming in on a more specific example of how we can start building out and expanding to maximize the benefit of these public lands. You can see in the South Fork of the Root River watershed, where pre-legacy amendment, we had a couple of kind of disjunct state forest management units, the Wet Bark unit and the Shattuck Creek unit, separated by, I want to say, about 5 miles between them. With legacy amendment funding, the Trust for Public Land, the Nature Conservancy, have both been able to make some large acquisitions that are now new wildlife management areas in between them. Additionally, Minnesota Land Trust has worked with several of those neighbors and acquired connected conservation easements. And then on all these lands, we've engaged in restoration projects and enhancement projects with DNR partners to elevate the quality of that habitat and make it so that now, you know, it's not a fully contiguous block of habitat in this corridor, but I kind of like to think of it as pearls on a, you know, pearls on a necklace of a connected corridor of habitat, where you have these landing spots of high quality habitat that are going to let plants and wildlife kind of find new landing points as they shift and adapt to climate change in the future. I know we're short on time, so I'm going to run through the next set of pictures really fast. I wanted to zoom in further on just what one restoration project looks like. This is Bluff Prairie on Choice Wildlife Management Area. When we acquired it back in 2015, this is what it looked like. And it's the state of a lot of bluff prairies in the Driftless area, where without prescribed fire or other forms of disturbance, native red cedar trees have been able to really take over and choke out the prairie habitat on that site. So after the acquisition, we were able to go in. We worked with a contractor to clear. This is 50 acres of very steep slope where we cut cedars, piled them up. This is what it looks like on the ground. They come in the next winter, burn off the piles. And so on this bluff, you know, this happened, kind of, I think, winter of 2016-17 and winter of 2017-2018. And after that, what we really have to do is adapt to what the site does. In this case, we got lucky and the grass responded really well and bounced back. There are a lot of other sites where there's a significant seed bank of invasive brush species, and we need to work for several years, often with goats, which were mentioned earlier, to control that brush. The end goal, ultimately, is to try to get that community back to a place where the grass community is healthy enough to carry fire, and we're able to use prescribed fire to manage it. And so this was 2021, which was the first burn on this unit. TNC staff participated, DNR led the burn. It was burned again in 2022. And this is what we get now. And it is a really great bluff prairie. It's incredibly diverse. It's excellent habitat for birds, pollinators. There are timber rattlesnakes, five-line skinks, race runners on this site. And this is one of those little blobs on that bigger map that I showed that I blasted through pictures here in, you know, 90 seconds that probably represents 7 years of work. And because of the continued support of the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, and then that's allowed our partnership to stay engaged and maintain the relationships that it takes to do this work year after year, we've been able to do exactly this kind of project, but at a landscape scale and have impact at that scale.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ruff. Any member questions? I know we're kind of pushed to get across the street. So thank you very much for coming forward, and I know you're available for questions. And
absolutely,
that habitat down there is really a special, special area. I mean, Minnesota's blessed with many special areas, but it really is a treasure. But it's important that we can really protect the water, because it just gets in the ground so fast and flies away. So anyways, thank you very much. And I know you'll be, like I said, available for questions. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any final comments? And go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, on behalf of myself and my staff and the council as well, I'd like to thank you for this time that we can present to you. And I'd like to make the offer, if any members have any questions on these or any other projects that there are out there, or ones you've heard about, or if you've got somebody in your district who's interested in maybe applying for money, please contact me. We're very happy to discuss, talk, help answer any questions we can.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Looks like we have one more question. Representative Heitzman.
Yeah, I was hoping to have
even
more time for
your sign, oh, sorry, says Mr. Backer Chair. There, but
sorry. Yeah, I was hoping to have a little bit more time, but with the limited time that we have, I just want to quickly mention, first of all, thank you for the presentation, Director, and those of you that presented today, I really appreciate that. But one of the problems that we're going to be talking a lot about, I think, this session, maybe in this committee, but more so in the Environment Committee as well, is going to be the need for an invasive carp barrier. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because there's no money. So that may be something that comes over to a discussion here in regard to Lessard Sams and what might be a possibility there. In the past, going back to 2012, there was work that the Lessard Sams has done on an invasive carp barrier going all the way up to 2019, and it might be something that needs to be revisited considering the potential impact. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments, and it is a real problem, and so as a state, we'll have to figure out how to address it. And again, thank you, everyone. The folder's back there that I know it, former Rep Green isn't going to probably be grabbing it, but maybe lead backer, you want to grab it on your way out? Or,
sure. I'll hit somebody with it.
With that, thank you, everyone. We'll have a meeting next week, and with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.